today on Against the Grain, urban renewal has done great harm to African Americans and other groups. How have Black San Franciscans responded to exclusionary forms of development? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Lindsay Dillon about race, place, and community organizing. Coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Making space for Black life in the city of San Francisco has been a long and arduous struggle. At times, the city and the state have had designs on neighborhoods like the Fillmore and Hunter's Point. Elites view areas of the city through certain lenses. Money, can this or that neighborhood serve commercial or financial interests? And race, can it be made more palatable, which often means more white, have guided urban redevelopment and renewal plans and projects. Black and other enclaves have not stood idly by. They have organized, they have resisted, they have sought to exert community control over how their neighborhoods were redesigned and rebuilt. Lindsay Dillon is assistant professor of sociology at UC Santa Cruz. She has a forthcoming book with the title Toxic City, Redevelopment and Environmental Justice in San Francisco. Portions of her research into the Fillmore District, and especially Hunter's Point, have appeared in a new volume called The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity. When Lindsay and I connected recently, I asked why her chapter, which focuses mostly on the post-World War II era, touches on the history of the city and region going back centuries.
As a geographer, I'm very invested in and interested in the history of a place, and also very conscious of like when history starts. And so, you know, in thinking about racial politics, particularly in the post-war era, my larger project has been thinking about the production of southeastern San Francisco as an industrial place, a place where it made sense, for example, to locate a military shipyard, a place of working class residents. And this history helps explain how and why Southeast San Francisco and Bayview Hunter's Point in particular became a place of a lot of public housing. It became kind of a segregated neighborhood where a lot of Black Americans were kind of pushed during and after World War II. And so it helps understand the layered histories and geographies of a place. And it also does the work, or potentially does the work, of destabilizing the notion that Southeastern San Francisco, for example, has always been a Black neighborhood. You know, it was also an Irish neighborhood and a Portuguese neighborhood and a place where Chinese Americans had a really vibrant fishing village. And it was also a really important place to Native Californians. And so just thinking about that long history of places and how they are produced helps us think about how specific politics emerge and subjectivities emerge and kind of the longer trajectory of a place.
You draw some parallels between the missions constructed in California by Spanish colonizers and Southern plantations. How were they similar?
So Southern plantations were totalizing systems. They, you know, were systems of land and labor, of capital and exploitation. The geographer Catherine McKittrick, who's one of the preeminent scholars of Black geography, writes that plantations, she writes this in an essay called Plantation Lives, plantations kind of prefigure the production of cities and the segregation of cities and environmental degradation and unequal environmental exposure in cities. And so she takes that plantation form and thinks about the way that it carries forward into the future and the way that we're still living with plantation geographies. And so part of the project of the chapter was to think about whether and how racial formations and racial violence differed from the South and in California and the West, and if there was a kind of specificity to California and the West in the way that racial politics and Black politics kind of emerged and what politics and resistance looked like. And I think this is evident in the beginning quote that I have, which was a quote by a young Black man in Hunters Point in 1963, speaking to James Baldwin. And the man says to James Baldwin, you know, you want me to tell you about San Francisco, I'll tell you about San Francisco. The white man, he's not killing you out of public like they're doing down in Birmingham, but he's killing you with that pencil and paper. And so I was thinking about these differences between racial violence and racial oppression in the South and in the West, and what were the specificities, what were the historical and geographical specificities of violence and resistance in the West. And so I also wanted to think about what are the specificities in terms of colonialism and its aftermath in California and the West. And for that, you really need to treat Spanish missionization and the impact of Spanish missionization on indigenous life, and the way that Spanish missions and the geography of missions in some ways established a landscape on which US settler colonialism and our current California political geography exists. And so I wanted to bring in the missions and think about them as a system of exploitation and a set of relations with land and labor similar to Southern plantations.
What you're saying then about indigenous people and how they were treated on missions, you're saying that there are many similarities between the way they were treated and the way that African Americans were treated on Southern plantations.
Yeah, missions were, you know, they were productive. There was cattle. There was agriculture, and so all the economy of the missions and the economy really of Spanish missionization, which included, you know, also presidios and pueblos, relied on indigenous labor. It's not the same, but I was saying it was similar to the reliance on Black and African American labor in Southern plantations.
And your brief kind of long history of kind of labor history in California includes the work done by Chinese workers brought to California in the 19th century. Why is this important to point out?
Well, I don't think you can really talk about racial politics and the long arc of California history without thinking about the reliance on California political economy in the West and really the nation on Chinese labor and in the shaping and making of California, both in its political and also physical landscape. And so, you know, as a sort of geographer and in a writing on historical geography, I didn't really feel like I could leave that out, but it was also really central to the way I approach thinking about Bayview Hunter's Point, which is to think about the ways that global circulations of people and capital and migration shape the making of the place. Even though we're talking about a small-ish neighborhood in the corner of the city, to think about the global political histories and routes that went into making the place that's sort of embedded in the soil and in the landscape and in the social geography of the place. And for this specific chapter, the experience of Chinese Americans in California and the ways that anti-Chinese racism really was the ways in which a kind of working class white politics emerged in the late 19th century was relevant because it had impacts for Black Americans later migrating to California. So the example that I give is that, you know, there was a really strong union politics in San Francisco. It's quite actually much more stronger than, for example, in Oakland or LA, but this was white labor politics. So the unions, the building and trades union, other kind of manufacturing unions or unions that supported manufacturing workers really guarded that white people's labor. And that had originated to keep Chinese workers out of unions, but it had really had implications for Black life in San Francisco.
Lindsay Dillon is my guest. She teaches sociology at UC Santa Cruz. She contributed a chapter titled The San Francisco Blues to a new volume called The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity. It's published by Duke University Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You note that before World War II, most African Americans moving to California headed to Oakland or Los Angeles, not to San Francisco. Does this have something to do with what you were talking about, the kind of the white labor power structure in San Francisco that emanated from, to some degree, anti-Chinese sentiment?
Absolutely. There were far less opportunities for manufacturing workers, for skilled workers in the building trades in San Francisco proper. By the late 19th century, there were much larger Black populations in Los Angeles, in manufacturing centers in Los Angeles and Oakland. And so people moved to these places because there were more job opportunities and because there was a larger kind of growing network of Black communities in those areas. And so, you know, up until World War II, census numbers tell us there were really only about 4,800 Black Americans living in San Francisco proper.
And what happened to the size of that Black population of San Francisco during the 1940s?
Or in the eve of the U.S.'s entrance into World War II, the U.S. Department of Defense put a tremendous amount of investment into the West Coast and especially in the San Francisco Bay Area. So at this point, you have the U.S. military taking over what was a private shipyard at Hunters Point. It becomes the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. There's also incredible investment in private shipyards in Oakland and in Richmond and in Sausalito. And military installations that are, you know, popping up or just kind of growing around the Bay Area. And so in a lot of ways, the Bay Area or parts of it become this wartime boom town. What's happening in the South also at this time is a tremendous shift in land and labor relations with mechanization. And so beginning in 1910, in what historians have called the Great Migration, there's a large-scale movement of Black Americans out of the South, in large part to northern cities or to places like Chicago, so industrial centers. And with all of this investment of the U.S. military in the West and in the San Francisco Bay Area in particular, there's just all of these job opportunities. And so that military investment shifts the geography of the Great Migration. And so you have a large-scale movement, not just of Black Americans, but working-class white Americans, to avail of these job opportunities in these growing job centers and boom towns. So during the 40s, the Black population in San Francisco grew by about 600%. And this is largely because of the availability of military jobs, but also people losing opportunities, losing jobs, the instability of life in the South with the mechanization of agriculture and the use of chemicals and so forth. So there's this push factor out of the rural South and this pull factor with military jobs and also the promise of California and a new beginning and kind of an escape from the South as well. And so, you know, San Francisco is a small city. And so the boom in population also becomes a housing crisis. And this is made even more acute by, during the war, the rise of white neighborhood associations and improvement clubs that restricted where Black migrants could live. And so you have most Black migrants during the 40s and 50s moving to the Fillmore District, and if they worked military jobs, to the military housing that popped up in Hunters Point in the 40s.
So the Fillmore District, can you tell us sort of, for those who aren't familiar with this city's geography, kind of where that is, and what impact did wartime Black migration into the Fillmore District have on that part of the city?
So the Fillmore, if you look at a map of San Francisco, is pretty much right in the center. But what's relevant to the history that I tell in this chapter is that it's relatively close to the downtown or the financial district. And so, you know, it's also called the Ruston Addition, and a lot of that area had developed after the 1906 fire. And in the 20s and 30s, so, you know, right before World War II, it was the primary kind of residential and center of like political and also cultural life for Black Americans, for the small population of Black Americans that lived in San Francisco. But it was really a cosmopolitan neighborhood. So there was a lot of Japanese Americans. There are a lot of European migrants, and people lived together in this neighborhood. With the war, you simultaneously have an influx of Black Americans looking for jobs and looking for houses and being shut out of either through economic or political reasons, a lot of the housing market in San Francisco. And at the same time, beginning in 1942, you have Japanese internment. And so one of the impacts of that internment is that it created space for Black Americans who were moving to find homes in the Fillmore. And so that area became even more so the center of Black political life. It also was an area that was known as an entertainment district. And so it was the jazz center of San Francisco, was where a lot of music was played, and a lot of that music production, that's the kind of sonic life, was music by Black Americans, blues, jazz, and kind of a mixture of sounds that was pouring out of these clubs. Simultaneously, the Fillmore is, you know, becoming overcrowded, and the landlords that own, you know, housing aren't keeping it up, and it's becoming more and more of a rundown area. And as San Francisco and Bay Area elites in the post-World War II era are trying to think, what's the future of this region? What's the future of San Francisco? And what is San Francisco's place in the region? The downtown kind of financial district becomes, it's growing at the time. There are more skyscrapers are growing up. San Francisco has increasingly become a financial center of the region and really the U.S. West. And there's more and more market and development interest in the Fillmore. And so this sets the stage for the urban renewal project by the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency.
Yeah, and we could talk for a long time about what happened to the Fillmore in the 1960s, but could you summarize, as you do very well in your piece, what urban renewal in the 1960s did to the Fillmore, did to that area and its residents?
So urban renewal was a set of projects that were carrying out around the country, and the idea of urban renewal was to address urban geographies that had become dilapidated. So urban renewal, there was a project started in the late 50s, and the Fillmore initially took a large-scale demolition approach of tearing down entire blocks, evicting tenants as a way of rebuilding what was seen as a blighted neighborhood. So it was a neighborhood where a lot of the structures were old and worn down. I mean, the history of that is that they weren't kept up by landlords. There hadn't been a lot of investment in this neighborhood. But there's also a regional context to the urban renewal project in the Fillmore, which is to say that in the post-war era, San Francisco's political economy itself was changing. So it had already been losing its manufacturing base. And this had been going on before World War II. But the post-war years accelerated that. The same with maritime, with the growth of the Port of Oakland, you know, the Port of San Francisco was losing its share of cargo. So in the post-war moment, San Francisco was becoming this financial corporate headquarters. Its service economy, its financial sector, its real estate sector, the insurance sector was really booming. And this shift in political economy, which was also a regional project by Bay Area elites. There was something called the Bay Area Council that emerged after the war. And this was a group of business people that, for example, pushed for the building of the BART system. And this is really, in this post-war moment, the creation of the Bay Area as a region. So the idea that these nine counties formed a region and there was a regional political economy is a post-war creation. So within that regional political economy, San Francisco was kind of a financial center. So within this post-war vision, this economic restructuring required a simultaneous spatial restructuring, a restructuring of the built environment that would facilitate or accommodate these new shifts in capital and labor. So one of the projects that was favored by business people associated with that Bay Area Council was the redevelopment of the Fillmore. And the Fillmore, as I mentioned earlier, was close to this growing downtown, this growing financial district. And so the state of its infrastructure and its built infrastructure was of great concern to pro-growth politicians and to business elites. And so, you know, it was designated blighted, and that allowed the new San Francisco Redevelopment Agency, which is new at the time, to go into the Fillmore and to redevelop it in a way that, you know, would house businesses, would attract more upscale residential interest. And this was predicated on evictions of Black businesses, of Black households. And so one of the impacts of that was not only to devastate a center of Black political, commercial, and musical sonic life, but also to push Black households both out of the city and or into already overcrowded housing in Hunter's Point. And so, you know, thinking about the history of Hunter's Point, it also needs to be thought in relationship to what was happening in the Fillmore at the time. My other interest in the Fillmore is because urban renewal landed much differently in Hunter's Point. There was a much more sense of ability to for the community to control what was happening in that neighborhood. And that's for a host of different reasons. But I think it's really interesting when we're thinking about histories of urban renewal nationally, but also in San Francisco, to kind of compare and contrast the Fillmore and Hunter's Point and how and why those projects were different.
That's the voice of Lindsay Dillon, D-I-L-L-O-N, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UC Santa Cruz. Her research focuses on environmental justice in U.S. cities, drawing from environmental history, urban geography, and critical race and ethnic studies. We are talking about a chapter she contributed about San Francisco and the Bay Area to the new volume, The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity. It's edited by Camilla Hawthorne and Jovan Scott Lewis. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So back in the 1960s, thousands of Black Hunter's Point residents lived in temporary structures built for military shipyard workers during World War II. What was that housing like, and how did policymakers and officials view this housing, this military temporary housing?
So part of my interest in thinking about Hunter's Point, maybe Hunter's Point, and from a long historical perspective, is also to understand that prior to World War II, Hunter's Point was not really a residential area. It was, there were a lot of cattle yards, there were some factories, it was an industrial district. And, you know, there were some working class houses kind of interspersed among industry, but most people lived in the Bayview district. And so this sets the stage for World War II when the US military takes over the Hunter's Point shipyard and builds out what were, I think, two commercial dry docks into this huge sprawling military complex. So they're blasting hillsides and kind of the shipyard spreads out into the bay. And so because the war was also produced a housing crisis in the city, San Francisco was able to avail itself of federal funds that was funding basically homes for military workers in cities because there was such great migration at this point. And so at the time, during the 40s, Hunter's Point basically becomes a residential neighborhood. And it, you have these really hastily built, quickly built, kind of barrack style military housing that's built on former cattle yards. It kind of goes up overnight. It's, it becomes a sort of temporary neighborhood for thousands and thousands of shipyard workers. So after the war, San Francisco is basically left with this unsustainable infrastructure. And part of it becomes, some of it's torn down, but a lot of it gets passed over to the San Francisco Housing Authority, and it becomes public housing. And what's important to note is at the time, the Housing Authority maintained a de facto segregationist policy, and it was concentrating Black San Franciscans in public housing in Hunters Point or in the Western Addition in the Fillmore. So it's becoming a Black neighborhood also through city agencies like the SFHA, the Housing Authority.
So you're right that in 1963, there were 232 buildings on the Hunters Point Ridge, housing around 1,700 people. And what happened? How were these people, and how was this housing especially viewed by policymakers, state and municipal officials in terms of the desirability of their continued existence going into the 1960s?
At the time, Hunters Point is still considered far away from downtown. It's considered both a socially but also a geographically isolated area. It's historically been hard to get to. I mean, that's changed in the past 15 or 20 years with the Muni T line that goes from, you know, the Embarcadero down to Hunters Point. But it's not a really accessible area. And so there is not a lot of market interest in Hunters Point in the 1960s. And so it's actually very interesting that the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency initiates and the Board of Supervisors initiate an urban renewal project in Hunters Point. Unlike the Fillmore, which is in the center of the city, it's close to downtown, in which Bay Area elites are really invested in the built environment and in that infrastructure and in kind of making that infrastructure more amenable to capital flows and connecting the Fillmore more closely with what's going on downtown San Francisco, which again is like the remaking of downtown San Francisco into this kind of financial center. So you have skyscrapers shooting up downtown at the time. Why is there a renewal, urban renewal project? Why is the redevelopment agency even interested in Hunters Point? And that had to do with a bill from the California state legislators that said that all war worker housing, all of this temporary housing built during the war, needed to be taken down by 1970. And so that's why we initially have an urban renewal project. What happens in 1964 in the late 60s is that there's suddenly a large amount of federal funds available for redevelopment. And that's with President Johnson's War on Poverty. So I can briefly say that the War on Poverty did a lot of things. It's a really controversial set of legislation. But one of the things it did do for redevelopment interests, which were both, you know, the interests of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency, but also the people that were living in these really dilapidated housing units. People in Hunters Point wanted to live there. They wanted to stay there. They valued their community, but they knew that they couldn't continue living in these current structures because they were just so run down. And so they wanted redevelopment as well. And so there was this moment of opportunity in the mid to late 1960s of having access to federal funds to rebuild in Hunters Point. And so just tracking a little bit forward, you know, thinking about what was different in Hunters Point versus the Fillmore, one of the things that's different is this lack of a lot of market interest in what's going on in Hunters Point. And so that gave both the redevelopment agency and also Hunters Point residents a lot more freedom to envision a different kind of urban renewal.
If the people working in this World War II worker housing wanted something new, how did they feel about the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency taking the lead in planning what would replace it?
So it's important to contextualize the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency's announcement that Hunters Point is going to be a redevelopment area, that there's going to be an urban renewal project in Hunters Point. There's first kind of like the ideas of this in the early 60s. I believe it's 1963 that the San Francisco Board of Supervisors kind of votes on this. But this is in the context of the ongoing devastation in the Fillmore, the razing of buildings, the demolition of entire streets, the displacement of Black businesses and Black households. And so by the time Hunters Point announces an urban renewal project, people are really suspicious of urban renewal. You know, James Baldwin famously called it a form of Black removal. And so there's an understanding that urban renewal, although in theory it promises a bright new modern landscape on Hunter's Point, can also spell the displacement and the loss of Black community there. And so Hunter's Point, where people had already been organizing to make the place a better place to live, residents, you know, begin to think about how they can make urban renewal happen for them. And so as one of a really prominent organizers at the time, Osceola Washington, said, you know, the issue is who is going to build what and for whom? And so what happened in Hunter's Point, and this was in part because of the resources and partly because of the funding available through the Federal War on Poverty that could fund organizations, that can fund redevelopment in Hunter's Point, but also because of the organizing that had been already going on in the late 50s and early 60s, is that residents got together and formed their own housing organizations with the goal of exerting what they would consider community control or a form of Black self-determination over urban renewal. So they weren't rejecting urban renewal, but they wanted to have a say in what was built, who it was built for, and also who was doing the building, right? Who was hired to do that kind of work.
Her name is Lindsay Dillon. She teaches sociology at UC Santa Cruz. She has a forthcoming book due out from UC Press next April. It has the title Toxic City, Redevelopment and Environmental Justice in San Francisco. And some of the insights you'll find in that book are part of a chapter that she wrote for a new volume called The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as to a link to Lindsay's faculty page at UC Santa Cruz. The program is Against the Grain, and my name is C.S. Song. Yeah, and the two organizations that were formed were the Bayview Hunters Point Community Development Corporation, or CDC, and the Joint Housing Committee. What visions for Hunters Point did these two organizations have, and did their visions align?
So these were just two organizations, but they were the most prominent probably housing organizations that I focus on. And they leadership on the Bayview Hunters Point CDC and the Joint Housing Committee overlapped. So they were had different purposes, which I will mention, but they had similar goals, which was that they wanted to control redevelopment in Hunters Point and make sure that it employed local Hunters Point workers. They pushed to hire Black architects to design the new development, and that this development project was not built as the director of the redevelopment agency, Justin Herman, had said in the early 1960s, to increase the property base of the city. Doing so would have had the effect of displacing many of the working class Black households that lived in Hunters Point, but that urban renewal or redevelopment in Hunters Point was built for the existing population. So the Bayview Hunters Point CDC was formed with the idea of providing an institutional structure to control and manage the new housing. So the CDC wanted to make sure that it wasn't private speculators or outside companies or even the San Francisco Housing Authority, which people in Hunters Point had been struggling with for many years. They wanted to control the new housing, to manage the new housing. And so there was this newish idea that instead of the public agency, the housing authority, instead of private outside agencies, that Hunters Point nonprofits or local organizations themselves would be these nonprofit sponsors or managers of the new housing developments in Hunters Point. So this was kind of a newish idea of the 60s. The Joint Housing Committee had as its primary goal to work with the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency on a master plan for Hunters Point, whereas the CDC was in some ways, although it got some federal funds, was autonomous from the state and in some ways in that sense took a more oppositional relationship to city agencies. The Joint Housing Committee worked closely with the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency to envision a master plan for Hunters Point, which included over 2,000 new housing units, but also a light industrial district so that people had jobs, so that they had not just homes that to live in, but also jobs to keep them in place. So the two organizations worked together, but they also sort of had separate goals.
How receptive was the SF Redevelopment Agency to working with the Joint Housing Committee and possibly adopting many of its ideas for how to plan a new Hunters Point?
What I read in the archives was in some ways a really remarkable shift of people in the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency from the demolition style approach that was initially taken in the Fillmore to a more collaborative relationship in which the redevelopment agency was actually really invested in collaborative planning to an extent. And so why was this the case? Well, to get back to what I was saying earlier, there was not a lot of market interest in Hunters Point. And so there was more leeway or freedom for this kind of collaborative planning with residents as opposed to what was envisioned for the Fillmore. But also the Fillmore Urban Renewal Project was met eventually with really firm resistance. And so there was a tremendous amount of anti-urban renewal, anti-redevelopment organizing taking place in the Fillmore in the early 1960s before urban renewal was even announced in Hunters Point. And this had was articulated with civil rights organizing in the Bay Area more broadly. So you had, civil rights organizers staging sit-ins and protests, and they were, laying down in the streets to prevent bulldozers from coming into the Fillmore as well. And so you had this kind of direct action political strategy, and Fillmore organizers were winning concessions. And so they were pushing urban renewal to look different in the Fillmore. And so in that sense, what happened in the Fillmore was not necessarily a complete devastation of the neighborhood to the extent that there is subsidized or affordable housing. That was the product of a lot of people's activism. And that activism spilled over and had effects in Hunters Point as well. And so by the time the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency turned to work in Hunters Point, not only was it operating outside of a real firm market interest in the neighborhood, but it was also kind of learning lessons that those Fillmore activists had had an effect on that, on the agency. And so they were, at least the archival record shows, much more amenable to a kind of collaborative approach that Hunters Point organizers were demanding. So it is not the case that the redevelopment agency came to Hunters Point suggesting a collaborative approach. It was that Hunters Point residents organized and demanded a say in what was happening. And so it is my kind of speculation that the Fillmore had become such a debacle and that, people in the agency were, in the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency were, having kind of conflicting opinions about what was actually going on in the Fillmore, but that by the time they got to Hunters Point, that working collaboratively, I would suggest was also an image management strategy for the agency. So there was a set of factors and sort of conditions and histories that kind of laid the basis for what was for a time a reasonably collaborative relationship in which, you know, the redevelopment agency supported Hunters Point residents' demand for Black architects, that they were working to some extent in relationship and supportive of a measure of community control over urban renewal. In the chapter, I gesture to the way that this really fell apart in the early 1970s with President Nixon's second administration, when he basically dismantles the war on poverty and all of the federal funding that had gone into or was going into redeveloping Hunters Point just goes away.
Lindsay Dillon joins us on Against the Grain. She teaches sociology at UC Santa Cruz. Again, we're talking about a chapter she contributed to a new volume. It's called The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity. And my name is C.S. Song. Right, so Nixon cuts back on urban renewal funding, and you had these plans devised by the Joint Housing Committee and Association in conjunction with the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency. So what happened to those plans? How much of what was on those plans realized?
The plans of Hunters Point organizers working with the redevelopment agency in the 60s were never fully realized, but there were, at least by the 80s, about 1,600 homes that had been built. And so you can see the sort of curvy streets and relatively modern, kind of 1960s, 1970s era homes on Hunters Point Hill today. They were subsidized, and so this was not public housing per se, but subsidized housing, and had been managed by a local nonprofit, which is one of them, at least, is still around today, Bridgepoint Housing, Nonprofit Housing Corporation. But because of the cut in federal funding, and this was specifically a piece of legislation called the Model Cities Act, not all of the homes that were promised were built. And organizers continued to struggle in the 70s and 80s, you know, in the absence of federal support to kind of realize their vision. I think what I want to say about this chapter is that what was most interesting to me was that vision, and also thinking about that vision and its political relevance to redevelopment and, for many people, gentrification in Hunters Point today. So I could focus on a kind of autopsy of how the planning project failed, because it didn't completely realize this vision of a new Hunters Point. And I could kind of go into why it didn't completely work out and why it wasn't a fully realized project. The goal of that chapter and my interest is to suspend that sort of autopsy of a failed development project and focus on the work and the vision of organizers, and to focus on what they wanted, the kind of control that they demanded over redevelopment, how the redevelopment of the built environment in Hunters Point was going to make space, as I write, for Black life in the city. And I mean that because redevelopment Hunters Point was taking place at the same time as this ongoing displacement project in the Fillmore. And a small segment of the chapter that has also been an interest of mine is the role of Black women organizers in housing and redevelopment projects. And not only the strength of Black women as activists, but also the ways that they hope to reshape the built environment to make the neighborhood also more supportive of caregivers. So there's a small detail that I found really meaningful, which is that, you know, in the design, in this neighborhood design for this kind of new Hunters Point that they imagined, parks for children were going to be located next to laundry facilities so that mothers or other caregivers could kind of attend to this labor of social reproduction more easily. And so it's a small detail, but I think it speaks to the role of women as activists and the role of women as and their emphasis on social reproduction and how that was envisioned into the built environment as well.
So as I've mentioned, Lindsay Dillon's chapter, the focus of today's program, can be found in a book called The Black Geographic, Praxis, Resistance, Futurity, edited by Camilla Hawthorne and Jovan Scott Lewis. And yeah, you are not one of the editors of this book, but I know you want to say something about sort of the overall project of this volume as you understand it.
Thank you. Yeah, so this chapter that I wrote in the volume was part of a broader research project I have, but I felt very honored to be included in the Black Geographic. And I do want to give a shout out to the two editors, Camilla Hawthorne and Jovan Scott Lewis, as really preeminent scholars in this emerging field of Black geographies, and this being a really important and perhaps even kind of field defining volume, in no way because of my chapter, but because of all of the collected works, the brilliant chapters that are in this book, and particularly also the introduction written by the editors. Black geographies as a field, as an emerging field, is a kind of interdisciplinary, multi-methods, transdisciplinary space that seeks broadly to make interventions in both Black studies and also critical human geography. You know, it recognizes, for example, that geography as a discipline, and I teach in a sociology department, but I am also trained as a geographer, and so I'm really invested in this project. So Black geographies as a discipline recognizes that geography has been itself implicated in histories of colonization and imperialism, and that these histories continue to shape traditional and mainstream geographic thought. And it posits that Black studies and critical human geography basically have something to offer each other. So Black geography scholarship often focuses on things like Black spatial imaginaries and how they undo or challenge traditional ways of thinking about space and place, thinking about the spatialities of racial capitalism and modes of resistance to it, and also struggles over urban space. And sort of that's where my research fits into a volume like this. The chapter itself tries to be geographical in the ways it kind of begins to tell a story of Bayview Hunter's Point from these kind of global historical routes and forces, you know, thinking about indigenous relationships to the land, Chinese immigration and 19th century labor politics leading up to the World War II and the post-war moment. And all of this is necessary in understanding kind of the embedded politics and a deep sense of the landscape in which current politics are unfolding. So one of the core ideas that Black geography, and this is just one, but one of the core ideas within the discipline of Black geographies is that Blackness, along with knowledge production, is always historically and geographically situated. So Blackness is non-singular, non-universal. And so it always emerges as does politics in relationship to place. And this is something that my chapter and my work more broadly really tries to take seriously in thinking about the relationship between consciousness and subjectivity and place. And Black geographies also places a lot of emphasis on forms of knowledge and perspectives that are historically marginalized. That's why the chapter, and there are many chapters in this volume that also turn to the geographer Clive Woods's concept of a blues epistemology. And so just really briefly, Clive Woods is a really important geographer who wrote a book where he theorized the blues, and he's writing about the Delta region in the South, the blues as not just a form of entertainment or a musical genre, but a knowledge system, a theory of political economy, a sociology, a philosophy. It's a he writes it's a blues epistemology, which means a way of knowing. And he also writes it's an ontology, which means it's a way of being, which is it offers or ushers forth other ways of being, other worlds, we could say. And he, in a kind of brilliant book, he traces the, he looks at the blues, he reads and interprets the blues as a knowledge system in relationship to working class Black consciousness and politics in the South. And what's important for me about Woods is that he's a geographer and he's writing about planning and regional planning and concepts of community development. He's asking, you know, why is there so much inequality and poverty and environmental injustice and racialized landscapes in the South? One of the things he says is that this wasn't inevitable and there has always been an alternative theory of human development, a theory of social development that centers concepts of justice. And we can see this and trace this through the blues. And so I took that concept of a blues epistemology to California and trying to think about working class Black consciousness and subjectivity in Hunter's Point and how organizers try to plan a different city. And, you know, really taking seriously the constraints that they were working with.
My guest Lindsay Dillon's chapter in the volume The Black Geographic is titled The San Francisco Blues. Her book Toxic City, Redevelopment and Environmental Justice in San Francisco is just out from University of California Press. She is a sociologist based at UC Santa Cruz. Lindsay, thanks for your work and for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate your interest and I really enjoyed speaking with you.
And that interview took place on November 29th, 2023. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.